G'day, I'm Tom Hollings, co-founder of Different Drop, and welcome to the Unfiltered Wine Podcast, where we chew the fat with our favourite wine industry characters and mates from Australia and abroad. On today's episode, I sat down with our good mate from Margaret River, Mr. Nick Peterkin of LAS Vino. What an amazing chat I had with Nick. This guy is so inspirational, so innovative. He makes some of the most dynamic wines in the country. I learned a bunch myself, and it was just amazing to pick his brain and unpack his story. So I hope you enjoy the chat. As always, you can find all of Nick's wines in our online store at differentdrop.com. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoy, and we'll see you next time. This is Unfiltered. G'day, Nick Peterkin. Good to see you, mate.
Hi.
The last couple of times I've seen you, it was at our big wine party last year.
Good times.
God knows what time that ended up. And the time before that, we were chewing down burgers at about 2 a.m. after you won the big James Halliday Award. So it's nice to actually see you in the light of day.
Yeah, 10 a.m. in the morning. It's a nice one.
Perfect time for Margaret River Cabernet, I reckon, 10 a.m. So how's things, mate? We've got a bunch of new wines that you've come to show us, and as always, really exciting releases, and I think you're at the forefront of the new Margaret River. Like, how's the business going? Because I mean, you've come from such a different place, and you've got such a fresh approach to how you make your wines.
It's going good. It's going really well.
I'm
going
to pour some.
Yeah, no, please. It's going really well. It's I mean, we were talking about it before. It's interesting, you know, how things have changed in the sort of wine industry itself in the last few years and the last sort of 5 years, and even the last, even since the beginning, you know, it's just been this sort of journey of sort of change. But I guess going into making wines, the whole approach with Las Vino was to do something a little bit different and delicious is sort of the ethos. So, like, I'm stoked with how they're sort of looking and how sort of the transition and how it's all sort of happened. I mean, Margaret River's going really well. We've just come off a really weird vintage, like really interesting vintage, like a good vintage, but just the earliest in record. Like, people were still, winemakers are still on holiday, you know, like in Japan and stuff. And if you'd booked on the last 100 years of records, it'd be pretty safe to go on a holiday in mid-January, and that's when we were picking. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, things are going well.
I mean, you've got, you talk about Margaret River, like you've got such a long, I guess, connection through your family, your parents, your grandparents, producers like Piero, Cullen, and now with your own label. So you've sort of seen the evolution of the region. Like, you're clearly doing something that hasn't really been done in Margaret River, and what, I guess, inspired that and continues to inspire you to make these wines?
I mean, you see, I came back to Margaret River after, like, studying winemaking and traveling and doing the traveling winemaker thing. And there was, this was in 2012 or 2011. And there was a glut, you know, there was a glut in Australian wine, and there still is. And so the point, and there's so many brands on the market. And so the big point coming into it was, like, I didn't want to add to the glut. I wanted to alleviate it in some way. And looking at those varieties, say, for example, like Chenin Blanc at the time, 10 years ago, growers couldn't sell it. Like, it was hard sell. So I was going, okay, well, this is a great grape. This is a great variety. And Soms love it. And it's, when you drink it, it's delicious. Why are people not drinking this? And then just putting a bit of love into it and care and making it in a way that people actually want to drink. And you can turn that sort of around. And so, I mean, if you look at the history of Australian wine, it's an interesting one. You know, you've got guys at every step. The guys, you know, like, I'm no way comparing myself to Grange, but
in any way,
but he did something revolutionary to create that wine when everyone was drinking port. And even people like the first guys in Margaret River, even just planting grapes, you know, like, or even I was in Franklin River the other day at Franklin Estate. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere. And you're like, it really took a lot of guts to go there and go, hey, a vineyard would work here. Or even, you know, Vas Felix back in the day, and, you know, my grandparents as well included in that, just starting something.
Going from zero to one, not just to 1.2.
You know, like I'm making some interesting wines and doing something a little bit different, but these guys were like revolutionary, you know? Yeah. Like, and what pains me in the Australian market is you see these guys making, guys and girls and whoever, not putting any love into a product, making it the exact same way as everyone else with the exact same label and the exact same bottle and expecting a different result. And then being surprised when it doesn't sell. And that kind of pains me a little bit. And you know, it's, I think you have to constant, and the industry has to constantly innovate and has to constantly change and update in a smart way in order to be successful. And we've got to play to our strengths. And Australian wine has like a lot of strengths going for it. So
you've got to think backwards from the customer, don't you? And I think that's what you've done. Because a lot of winemakers we talk to have always background in making wine. They're assistant winemakers or they came from a winemaking family and they go, we want to work with this fruit. We want to make wines that look like this. And then they go and make them. And then afterwards they go, okay, now how are we going to get to sell them? And then they eventually come to the market and the wines are too expensive or not packaged well or just a confusing narrative or there's too many wines, different blocks, different sites, whatever. And it's like, no, think about the consumer and what's going to excite them. Because like, I look 100%. At this. Right, this the Albino Pinot, just to segue on this wine for a second, like, you know, this is a totally standalone, unique wine in Australian wine, right?
I hope so.
It's a fucking expensive rosé.
No, but it is.
So delicious and so worth the money and so popular. Like, it just sells out, you know, quickly every year. What's the blend about? It's Pinot Chardonnay.
80% Pinot and 20% Chardonnay. And I mean, like, when I did the blend originally, I was talking to my old man about it and I was like, what are you going to do? I was like, I'm going to make, and I didn't even think of it as a rosé. Like, yeah. It was like, I'm going to make a white Pinot Noir, you know, like, and I think if we put a bit of Chardonnay in it, that'll work. And everyone loves strawberries and cream. I mean, like, why don't we try to create that in the bottle? And it wasn't even going to be Pinot. It was looking through and going, okay, how do you get strawberries like in wine and looking at the varieties that had it.
Right. So you were actually thinking because that strawberries and cream has been how this wine has been described. That was the starting point.
And so it was the starting point going, okay, what varieties have cream and how do you get that? What varieties have strawberries and how do you get that? And then we ended with Pinot Noir because we were like, okay, if you pick Pinot Noir early enough, it has distinct aromas of strawberries. And then if you use Lee's work and a bit of Malo, especially with Chardonnay, you can get a creamy character. And it's just developed from that point. And then I was like, as soon as we realized it was Pinot, I was like, the Laspino, Albino, Pinot. And my old man was like, that is the stupidest name. You know, like, nobody's going to drink that. And I mean, you know, yeah, I don't want to go. Yeah. Like, I've had other things about the sort of, yeah, calling it Albino, you know, that people are like, oh, that's just offensive. And I'm like, it's one of the better rosés in Australia. Like, if I was Albino, I'd be so happy about that. You know, like, it's not derogatory in any way. I think it's really important. Like, it makes it also easier. Like, you know, to be honest, if I'm just making Semillon Sauvignon Blanc for Margaret River with a white label at $25 a bottle, I'm against.
Could you go and do that for us, please?
I'm just joking. Like,
there's enough.
You're up against 2,000, 3,000 labels at the same price. And I mean, like, there's so much good stuff out there. It's like, you can't win. I mean, that's the best Albino Pinot in Australia.
Yeah.
But there isn't another one. Yeah. You know, like, maybe it's not the best rosé, but it's the best pirate blend in Australia. It's the only one. You know, like, so it just makes it easier because you're competing in your own category,
yeah,
kind of thing.
So, yeah. And then the way you package them up, the way you present them, and then allows you to then price them, you know, at a good price where I think it's fair for the amount of work and love that goes into them, but also almost separates them from this ocean of $30 wines. And it's going, no, this is better. This is something, you want something really different, you want something really amazing, try this.
I mean, to tell you the truth, like hand waxing all of the bottles is a massive pain in the ass. And we do every single one by hand.
Yeah.
And it's not because it's more convenient, like it's or cheaper. It's because it shows that we care. You know, it shows that we will do every single bottle by hand because we handpick all of the grapes. It's a reflection of it.
Yeah.
You know, like if I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't. Like, it takes forever. But it's a beautiful touch. It shows that sort of a handmade sort of craft of it. And it's a reflection of that as well. And the labels, I mean, the labels are hand-drawn because the wine's handmade. And we wanted that to be a reflection. So thoughts, I mean, hopefully a bit of thoughts gone into it.
I love this lineup here because you've got, it's a Margaret River, producer Margaret River tasting, and there's no Chardonnay, say for 20% in this, and no Cabernet. Now, you make some amazing Chardonnays and Cabernets, and it was tempting to pour them, but I love this kind of focus on these almost forgotten varieties or lost vineyards in the region. And, I mean, this thing, the CBD with the Shannon, I love what you were saying off air a minute ago about the inspiration behind this wine.
Yeah, I mean, this wine actually came when I was studying winemaking. We this South African guy called Bertus Fleury, I can never get the Dutch sounding name, but Fleury came over and he poured the best of South Africa. That for all us, you know, pleb university students, and he was pouring these wines and they were incredible. You know, like these Chenin Blancs and some really good reds as well. And I said, tasting these, and like these three Chenins, and they were outstanding, like very, very good. And you're there going, okay, the South Africans are dominating this. Like these are, that's it. We have so much Chenin Blanc planted in Margaret River. I know this, like I've been around Margaret River my whole life. There's a lot planted from the Amberley days.
Yeah.
And why isn't anyone making this, you know, or in this style, you know, like hand-picked and barrel fermented? And that sort of just led me on this sort of journey with Chenin to sort of discover it and be like, okay, well, and you talk to, say, guys like you, or even say if I came here 12 years ago or 10 years ago and was like, hey, you know, I really want to sell Chenin Blanc to you guys. You got no one really buying it.
Yeah.
You know, like we love it.
Yeah.
You know, we love it, but no one's really buying it, so we're not going to take it. And you talk to sommeliers and they'd say the same thing, and they're like, I love it. And you talk to winemakers, and they're like, man, best grape ever. And you're like, okay, why the fuck is no one drinking it? Like, everything's matching up here. Like, people should be drinking this grape. And it just came down to making it the right way, treating it with love, picking from vines that were actually, like, vineyards that were actually good. All of these things that have been established with Margaret River, well, the world over, with, say, Chardonnay, site selection, picking the right grapes for the right site, picking at the right time, hand-picking it, treating it with love and care, not just machine harvesting off young vines and turning it into shitty wine.
Fruit salad.
If you care about it, it ends up being absolutely delicious. And then from that point of making, you know, an interesting, yummy wine, going into the market, people trying it and going, look, just taste it. You like it. People are like, I don't like sweet wine. So, Chenin Blanc's not sweet. You just try it.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as people try it, they're like, wow. And then the beautiful thing that happened with Chenin Blanc is this movement around it, a lot focused from Margaret River and the Swan, of a collective action and everyone pushing it. And without that, it would never have got off the ground. Like, I'm the tiny little voice, you know, like.
And still got a way to go, or at least
over east,
definitely. But the wheels are in motion now.
Yeah.
And there is now you've got the enthusiasts, I think, that are keen on the variety. So you've got the Somms, the producers, the Somms, the independent retailers, the wine writers, mostly love it. And now you're getting just the up and coming drinkers, the younger drinkers that are keen to try things. They're getting into it, and then hopefully then after that you start to get a bit more mass market.
You go to London, or you go to South Africa, but you go to London, it's established.
Yeah.
You know, people know what it is. People know that South Africans kill it, and they know where it sits on a wine list, and they know the rough price. We're still catching up in Australia and the gutter. I sold more of this in the UK originally. I couldn't sell a bottle in Australia when I first released it. I sold most of it to the UK because that market was already established. And so now it's sort of happening, and it's beautiful. And I mean, like with this site now, Marywood Park, where we get the fruit, it's certified organic and certified biodynamic. And it's this just beautiful site. And it leads to this very unique expression of the wine itself. And so when you see it in a lineup of just even Margaret River or West Australian producers or Australian producers, it looks distinct and interesting within that scope of a variety that is distinct and interesting, which is cool as well.
It's so delicious. I love this wine ever since you started making it. And it's got an incredible, just a little taste, incredible length. Like it stays with you. A real purity to the fruit. Like you can see very well-farmed fruit there. Mm. And obviously organically farmed, as you say, biodynamic. And then the texture that you're working in, that barrel ferment and lees working.
It's interesting, the conversation about texture. You know, like back in the day, like when we were making wines for Piero, we'd almost like actively try everything to reduce phenolic content. You know, like not reduce it, but just like we wouldn't want texture is bitterness, you know, is the enemy. And like the more I'm developing on like this wine journey, the more I'm trying to search for it. Like search for that texture and not, I don't want to say minerality, but search for that texture and try to build that in ways that don't have bitterness, but just it gives like a, it's almost like, it's a weird analogy, but like chili, it's like, it's not a flavor, but it's a different sensation.
Yeah.
And it just adds to that experience in taste. So, you know, using a clay amphoras, build texture, and with this CBDB this year, just a little bit of skin contact builds texture. Yeah, it's cool. And also not fining the wines, that's another thing that builds texture, but you have to treat the wine so carefully, like in order not to fine them, like you do have to do hand picking.
Talking to you about how you make your wines and like reading when you do your like winemaking notes, there's all these little techniques and details that you're implementing into making these. Like, is that, where do you think Margaret River's at with that kind of approach to making wine? Like, You're doing things very differently, different varieties, different styles, flavors, different winemaking. Like, are you out there on your own?
No.
Or like, because we see other guys doing some interesting things, but is the region as a whole trying to move in that direction?
It's funny. Like, talk to, say, Virginia Wilcox of Vast Felix, and she'll, like, open tastings being like, guys, we're all sitting on this high horse in Margaret River. It's like, you go on the world set, no one knows where we are. You know, like no one knows what Margaret River is. Like, get off the high horse kind of thing. It's like we're this tiny little spot from this tiny little country on this world stage. So, like, you know, like get over yourself kind of thing. And I think the cool thing about Margaret River, and this goes to the history a little bit. Do you want me to talk about the history? It's kind of cool.
It's kind of nuts. Yeah.
So you've got these.
I just want to learn.
Well, I don't know. I'm nervous doing this on camera because, like, I don't want to like anyone to be upset. Like, kind of being a bit like Margaret River started. Like, if you look at Australian wine in comparison to Margaret River as a region, the other regions in Australia started through farming families, like immigrant farming families, which is fantastic. But it kind of established the attitude of how the wine was made.
Mm.
And so you're a farmer, you've got your wheat, you've got whatever, and you've got a vineyard, and that would start a region. Whereas Margaret River was started by, and it was on the value of the produce, maybe even the quantity produced. You know, you bought Shannon because it was a great yielding variety and you wanted yield. Mm. Didn't matter about the quality as much. And, you know, obviously things have changed like since the beginning point. But I think the starting point's an interesting sort of thing. And so Margaret River, you've got this region that is established by three doctors. You've got Dr. Cullody with Vast Felix, Dr. Cullen at Cullen Wines, nearly forgot, and Dr. Pannell from Mosswood.
Yeah.
And those guys didn't give a shit about how much volume they produced.
Mm.
But they were, in some ways, they were competing against each other. And these guys were drinking good wine, you know, like really good wine from France. And so they were there going like, well, I just, you know, try my cap. You know, they go in and be like, oh, try this, try that. Didn't matter that, oh, well, I made this much money or I made this much volume or my vineyard got this much yield. It was always about quality. And from that little triangle, that starting point, if you wanted to enter the circle, you come in on the basis of quality, not on yield, not on how much you were producing and that kind of thing. And I remember like chatting to my grandma, this is a long time ago, when this like big winery came in at the time and they've sort of like high horse, like, we're going to, it was early 2000s, and like, we're going to revolutionize this, and that fireworks, and like, big volume, low price, da-da-da-da. And my grandma was like, she was like, this, she didn't go to the opening. And then she was like, this isn't going to be successful. And she's like, and this isn't good for Margaret River. And they failed, like, within 10 years, they failed. And it's kind of this interesting dynamic, like, Margaret River is a very quality-based thing. So are most people handpicking their entire range? No, no, definitely not. That nearly most good Margaret River producers would be handpicking their Chardonnay and handpicking their Cabernet. But I do fuck all. You know, like I'm a very small producer on the scale of things. I can do it because it's such a small production. If I got bigger, I probably would do machine harvesting. So the benefit of being small is being able to do the attention to detail and experiment. Because of that, the price is a little bit high, but hopefully the quality is there. Margaret River as a region, we are focused on quality, definitely, above volume, above anything. And I think that's the spear tip. Volume can come underneath quality.
Does that obsession with quality conflict with innovation? Because there is something you sacrifice by trying new things. You risk something not working or taking time. Like you, when you've come up with these wines, it's a long term, and you go, "This might not work."
It doesn't work,
and that's a really hard thing to do. To go, I can just make a great Cabernet and Chardonnay here and probably sell that, or do I do what you're doing, or what Dormelona's doing, or Tripascariot, or Sievinters, or whoever else. You know, that is there's a courage, I think, to try.
Yeah, but this goes back to the beginning of conversation. I mean, imagine having the courage to plant a vineyard in Margaret River when no one else had, or in Franklin River, you know, like, or making a blend when everyone was drinking port. I mean, that's courage.
You couldn't get a better segue. Just quickly, the poor, you're talking about drinks courage.
That's
courage in the face of pirates.
So the red
we got here, the artist formerly known as the Portuguese Pirate
Blend. The Portuguese Pirate Blend.
Now, talk about something different, because this is what, Tarrega Nacional, Tintacao, Suso.
Yep.
Just your classic kind of
classic Margaret River red. Margaret River blend. I mean, coming into Margaret River, and I do make Cabernet now just because it's this exceptional vineyard.
Sellout.
Yeah, I know. And I think of it like that. I think of it like I'm a sellout. I'm making Chardonnay and Cabernet. But the Pirate Blend, I actually did a vintage in Portugal when I was 17. I was like the world's worst employee, but we got paid like €2 an hour. It sucked. The work, I'm not going to mention the winery, but it was hard. It was a hard work. But being there at that age, realizing that Tarrega was their Cabernet or was their Shiraz, you know, like it was their premier variety. And then at uni, I actually randomly got assigned the grape as well. And, you know, we made a little wine and we actually made a port as well. And so the thought goes into the same sort of thing as the Shannon. It's like, okay, this really works in Portugal. Everyone's drinking it. It's very popular. Why are we not doing this in Western Australia? And I didn't even know that there were grapes and, you know, these sort of varieties in Margaret River. And when I came back, somebody actually told me, Sky Orpap actually has a few of those varieties. If you're keen, I know you've mentioned it a few times to me. I was like, yeah, let's give it a crack. You know, that'd be really fun. I'm interested in that. Like that's exciting. It's different. It's not just another Cabernet or another Chardonnay or another SSV. Yeah. So, and so made this blend, and this is the sort of tenth. This is the ninth.
Such a popular cuvee over the years, isn't it? Medium bodied, a little bit more in that lifted, you know, energetic mid-weight style in the last year or two, which I personally love. Spicy, savory, kind of like dark fruit. Really, really interesting.
I get like Christmas spices, always with this. And I don't know where it comes. Like, we don't really use much new oak. Like, maybe not even 10%. And so I'm getting all of this like nutmeg and cinnamon and that kind of thing. I'm like, where does it even come from? You know, like it's an issue because normally they associate that with oak, but. Yeah, it's a very interesting wine, and it's very interesting aromatically.
Yeah.
And then on the palate, I almost want to say, it's got the same structure as a Margaret. Like, in some years, this year probably not so much. It's more medium weight. But in other years, it's like got the same structure as, say, a Cab Merlot with completely different flavor and aromatics, which is cool. A really, really cool sort of thing. So
I guess the theme is what courage? I mean,
the theme is like, just back to your question, does innovation hinder quality? And you just have to be willing to, and all of those guys that you mentioned are fantastic producers, and they all take risks. But I think, and this is, it's a funny thing, and I'm nervous about saying this on camera, but like I see this in my family and I see this with older winemakers, and it's not just winemakers, it's in business in general. And I see it in myself, the older you get, the less risk you're willing to take. And you just want to play to your successes and you almost cherish them. You're like, oh, well, let's not stuff this up. People really like that. And that's how innovation ceases. But if you take risks each year, just considered risks, with the thought that it can stuff up and you'll lose that money or you'll lose that or you might have to drain it, you can, it just pushes everything forward a few notches. And I mean, like every year with La Spina, we try to do an experiment. I look at like, you know, guys like at Noma, like they have a test kitchen. They're running things all the time, you know, and most successful kitchens around here would be doing that.
Just thinking about the Vermentino, the sea wine.
Yeah, and I mean like, and that, that's a there's a crazy idea.
Yeah.
And
so good.
It's just crazy. But that came from some friends that were doing vintage with us, Teresa and Maria. And they're like, and that's their crazy idea. You know, they're like, take that risk. And it's like, yeah, let's.
How do you hang on to that willingness to, because, you know, I look at our businesses are a similar age. Yeah. You know, we're a similar age. Two kids each, you know, and you do get to that point where you're like, oh, gosh, I don't ever want to take any more risks. I just simplify things.
Yeah,
you do. But then your risk sitting still and becoming irrelevant. How 100%. And I feel like Australian wine in general, we're still such a young winemaking country, and, like, we should be doing different things. And it doesn't mean do different stuff for its sake, but I feel like we haven't discovered yet what our identity is and why our styles are.
100%. And, I mean, like, being young – it is the hardest thing is doing, and I mean, like, here's my plug, Las Vino, luck, art, and science. You know, you've got to have the luck, and Australia's an incredibly lucky country. The art is that experimentation and that thinking of just going, what if you did that? Or what if you did this? Or how could this be better? And then applying the science to it and going, okay, well, how can we do this within the bounds of science where it's not going to be a complete disaster. And also having being willing to wear the risk where the experiment doesn't work. That Vermentino, we did four barrels of it. One barrel was incredibly salty. You know, like it tasted like a margarita. Like it was like salt in a barrel. And it was like viscous and it wasn't good. But we've turned that into a vermouth. You know, like we've added sugar to it and balanced it out. And that idea came just being open to the idea from a somm in Sydney who was like, tasting, he's like, this isn't good. You shouldn't put this in the blend. He's like, but this could make a killer vermouth if you put like sea herbs and stuff in it that we've turned it into a vermouth. So it's that being openness to it. But it's not being different for different sake. It's being different to go, can we up the quality? Can we make the industry better? What's going to work on the world stage? Let's not do the same things that have just come before just because they were done. How can we make better wine? Like,
and with your background growing up in this region, knowing the region inside out, all of your winemaking experience, I guess it gives you the opportunity to try things knowing that, you know, I can turn this into something.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's more something I need to see a therapist about, but like, yeah, maybe it gave me a little bit more confidence. But I guess the difference is, you know, going back to that risk, this is more of a business conversation, but when you started this, say this company, even with La Spina, it doesn't work. You're in no worse position.
No, in your 20s, whatever.
Yes, you know, like it's like, oh, people didn't enjoy it. Who gives a shit? Whereas when you get a bit older and like you built the brand into something and you've built the reputation and you have people that are loyal to what you're doing and, you know, you risk losing that credibility. And I guess that's the trouble. And I don't have an answer to it. I think bigger minds than me would have thought about it even more and don't have an answer to it. So,
well, mate, thank you so much for not just for today, but for, you know, we get inspired by the many great producers we get to work with.
Well, I actually really like froth on watching the videos and, you know, watching winemakers come in and seeing what they have to say about the wines. And so it's cool.
Now you can watch yourself on loop.
Yeah, fantastic. Can't wait.
But it is an inspiration for us, your innovation, your energy, just the way that you think and approach wine and your business is different. And I think, you know, we always try and harness a bit of that, gosh, I don't know what, courage, I guess, for want of a better word. So just to, it is though, you know, to do things differently and take chances.
Well, it's
so
thank drop, you. Mate.
It's different drop. It's in the name, you know. Same old drop wouldn't quite have the same ring to it.
But I mean, yeah. I mean, we could talk about this off camera. But I mean, like, you know, if you went into it and go, maybe this, no, look, let's roll with it. But if you went into doing different drop, and this is how I think of Australian wine in a lot of, I'd say 50% of Australian wine. If you went into different drop, go, I'm going to have the exact same wines that Dan Murphy's has at the exact same price, but just a dollar higher because I'm smaller and I can't compete. Mm. And I'll have locations that are closer to them. And then in a year, you'd be like, no one's buying my wine. You know, like, why? And it's the same Australian wine. It's like exact same varieties, exact same labels, exact same price. And it's like,
and then you're surprised.
And then you're surprised. It's like, but if you're doing something differently and you're going, okay, well, I'm going to be putting out different producers that no one's heard of from different regions that are doing really high quality stuff, but they're not getting the mainstream thing because they're maybe smaller or they're eccentric or whatever, you know, like, and I'll be the only person doing that. And I'm going to do it online focus, whereas, you know, as opposed to bricks and mortar and have, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, and it becomes successful because it is different and because it's not just different, but it's quality and it offers values to people. I mean, like, that's how you've got to think of everything, you know, not just wine or, you know, business. And so it's a cool thing seeing, say, different drop being successful following the same ethos, you know, like this isn't a unique ethos. It's an ethos that works. And I'd love to see the Australian wine industry be even more successful than it's been over the last 50 years. So, you know, I just hope that, yeah. More producers, be like me. It's like, don't be like me. It's like, find the unique thing that makes you ridiculously special and harness that and push it, you know, like, so yeah.
Mate, awesome to finish on. Thanks, Nick. That's great fun, bro.
Thank you very much.
Good on you, mate.
It's good to be here.
Cheers, guys.